So, welcome to This Week in Health Law. I am Nicholas Terry. I'm a professor of law at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis.
And I'm Frank Pasquale, a professor of law at University of Maryland in Baltimore, Maryland.
And our job is to try and talk about some of the topics that interested us in the world of health law, health policy this week. And I'm going to start with something that I need to confess is a little bit personal, in that I'm going to talk about the Anthem health insurer breach involving potentially something like 80 million records. Financial, health, and so on. I don't know many Anthem Health subscribers, but I do know one, and that's me. So I am one of the people who are now getting the helpful emails from Anthem and from my employer that pays them, talking about various precautions and so on. So, to be fair to Anthem, we don't know very much about the breach yet. That's a forensic matter, and we're just going to have to wait to find out more about that. From the legal perspective, I think, however, it gives us an opportunity to sort of review the steps that a health insurer, a hospital network, even a doctor's office is required to take through the so-called HIPAA security rule. And that HIPAA security rule says that the holder of the data, your health data, has to have administrative safeguards. That means that you have to, like, appoint a privacy officer and stuff like that. You have to have physical safeguards. It's not much good in having really great electronic security if someone can just walk in the building through the back door and steal all the stuff. And you have to have technical safeguards. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because as far as we know, the data that was accessed or in some way compromised was not encrypted. A lot of us use encryption these days. Every time we buy something from Amazon, you see the little padlock pop up on your browser for end-to-end encryption. More and more of us are taking care of our computers by encrypting the hard drive. I know my traveling computer is encrypted like that. So I guess a really interesting question is why isn't there a requirement that health data be encrypted, not just when it's being moved around, but also when it's standing still in a big database? And the answer is that under the HIPAA security rule, that is not a requirement. Instead, it's what's known as an addressable precaution. So that means that the data custodian, in this case Anthem, merely has to address whether encryption is necessary or not, doing a risk-benefit analysis. And if they decide not to, they have to document that. And I guess the question for me is, while that is the state of the law at the moment, a different question, of course, is whether we want to change that and make encryption mandatory. But in the current state of affairs, I just find it rather difficult to justify a lack of encryption. In April 2014, the FBI sent out a private industry notification to the healthcare industry, saying you're under threat. This stuff is coming, and you're not very good at protecting yourself. And that notification actually said within it, all of you seem to be using perimeter controls, you know, firewalls and authentication and stuff like that. But the data doesn't suggest that it's safe enough. So for me, I think it poses the question as to whether existing law is sufficient to do this, or whether we need to just make this mandatory, Frank?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said for encryption, but I also want to put some of the downsides out there, because I've been talking to, you know, people, chief information security officers, some other folks that work in the area, and I've heard from a few folks that the big worry and big problem with encryption is that you may have lots of communications between different entities that don't use the same types of encryption. And so the worry is that, you know, you end up with this babble of information, and it's hard for groups to talk to one another or to make the data interoperable, portable, et cetera. And I think we also need to acknowledge some of the policy tensions here. If you look at, like, the 10-year ONC-HIT plan, the Office of National Coordinator of Health Information Technology, clearly, you know, interoperability is a big concern of theirs. And so I just wonder about on the technical side. Now, I'm sure there's some wizards out there that have probably got this figured out and locked down and figured out a way to balance this tension. But I still think for the average entity facing these problems, it may be they may be facing a risk-benefit calculus where the benefits may seem kind of, or the benefits of encryption may seem far off. It might seem very difficult to actually accomplish them, whereas the costs are immediate and upfront. So, I don't know. I mean, I also have to wonder if this is seen by some providers as an unfunded mandate. You know, and I think that would certainly lead them to balk at forcing encryption onto everything. I mean, do you like the unfunded mandate characterization, Nick, or do you think that's unfair?
Well, I mean, that's been a tag that's been placed on all things HIPAA since its introduction, right? I think that health law, or I beg your pardon, health care, really has fallen so far behind the rest of developed industries in their technology. And I mean, you mentioned interoperability. There's a great example where we're still using proprietary formats for electronic medical records instead of using a modern, a fully portable interoperable format. So I think you are correct that the risk benefit analysis as performed at the moment would have perverse incentives. It would slow things down. But at the same time, one wonders what else is going to jolt the healthcare systems into doing something to improve their technology.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I can see that there's definitely a need to get more investment in the IT side here. I mean, I know that in other industries, like in finance, it's estimated that 10% of the spend is on IT and making sure the IT is up to date, and then healthcare, it's a much lower percentage. I don't know exactly how you benchmark it, but I do think that this is an area where you're absolutely right to sort of sound the alarm. One thing I'm also wondering about is how does this fit into a larger sort of cybersecurity framework? I mean, if we look at I saw some reports saying that Chinese hackers may have been behind the Anthem breach. I don't know if they've got the attribution problem down or not, but it does seem as though, is it a health sector problem, or is it in part a military sector problem? I don't know. I mean, but you have a much better knowledge of, like, the broader range of data breaches and how many have been caused by things that really were foreseeable and preventable, right? And I imagine Sure. that's where you're coming from. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, again, not wishing to pick on my health insurer, but this is not Anthem's first rodeo. yes. With regard to a security rule breach and a very large fine a year or two ago. I just think that from top to bottom, horizontal and vertical axes, we have to pay so much more attention to the risks in healthcare security. And I think as we go more and more to sort of individual devices, this will be a show probably all on its own when we talk about mobile health and so on, we're going to have to demand that if these devices are going to be our access points to healthcare, then they're going to have tokenization like Apple Pay for transactions and biometric identification like fingerprint scanners and so on. One's not pretending this is an easy nut to crack, but it's about time.
And in terms of so let me bring in a little bit of the privacy conversation then, just to play devil's advocate, in terms of the biometric identification, I know that in the health privacy conversation, there has been various proposals over time to create unique personal identifiers, unique numbering or what have you for individuals within the healthcare system. And then often privacy advocates have been opposed to that. And I can think of, you know, nothing more unique than some of the biometric identifiers that, you just mentioned. Do you think that the privacy advocacy community is ready for proposals of biometrics to enhance security? Or do you think that their commitment to privacy is going to be so intense that they're going to oppose that?
Well, I think that the task will be to show how you can handle type of security without negatively implicating privacy. So if you do go over to a unique identifier, what are the ways, for example, that you can kind of silo that off, or silo the social security numbers off in sort of different data pools that are far more far less easy to access if there is a breach? But the other kind of interesting thing this week, which the Anthem breach was last week, but we have a little action this week, of course, is that going directly to your point, the president in his Stanford address introduced the idea of far more cybersecurity sharing between technology companies, and the hope of increasing security that way. That opens up a horrible hornet's nest at the moment, doesn't it? Because Silicon Valley does not trust Washington, D.C. when it comes to privacy and security. For us, the legal issue is that this is being used as a lever to bring in a federal data breach notification rule. And as you know, data breach notification rules are not one of my favorite tools. It is the quintessential statement that the barn doors have been left open and the data is already in China. But that proposal may not actually help us much in healthcare, because we already have a national health breach notification rule that was authorized by the 2009 HITECH Act. So we're kind of already there. So it's hard to see what the latest proposals from the White House really bring us. But I think that's probably enough on the horrors of the HIPAA security rule, the closest thing in law to seeing paint dry on a wall.
Can I add one other thing, though, on this, Nick, I mean, which I just find kind of amazing, is I saw a story in Cleveland.com that said that people are wanting to pay $15 to freeze their credit reports at the three major credit bureaus, and Anthem is refusing to reimburse them for even doing that. And, you know, to me, it's like, I feel like at times like these, you really hope that the industry is going to step up. And I imagine it's not that many people that are going to pay this $15. You know, I mean, we all know from all experience with these things that people are pretty phlegmatic, lethargic as it is, you know, in responding. And it just, it's flabbergasting to me that they're not offering to pay this relatively small fee on behalf of people. Moving from the ONCHIT and HHS interpretations of HIPAA security, et cetera, I'm going to move to another new initiative, or big relatively recent initiative from the federal health systems, and this is on Nursing Home Compare. So on February 12th, CMS announced that in Nursing Home Compare 3.0, this third version of Nursing Home Compare, there would be revisions to the Nursing Home five-star quality rating system. And this, I think, is a really interesting development. And just to give a little bit of background to our listeners, if you go back to, you know, 10 years ago or so, at that time, the health policy conversation was all about consumer-directed healthcare. And one of the key parts of consumer-directed healthcare was this idea that consumers could only make an educated choice if they were able to rank and rate and compare what was going on in different parts of the healthcare system and compare different providers against one another according to some commensurable metric. All that means is that, you know, you could have 1 to 5 stars that would be about big data points about the providers. And although a lot of consumer-directed healthcare has sort of gone by the wayside, and if people want to know why, Tim Jost's book on consumer-directed healthcare is the place to go for that. But some parts of consumer-directed healthcare have hung on and have gone on to influence major parts of American health policy. And one of those is the physician compare, nursing home compare, hospital compare, et cetera. And these are websites. You can go on to the, just Google any of those nursing home compare, et cetera, to go onto the web, and you can see, you can set up charts that let you compare two, three, I think sometimes even five different providers and see how they're doing overall, and then you can get more granular data. And essentially with this, to bring us up to 2015, what's happening now, what's happening with the HCMS is that they are making the system harder. So a lot of people complained in the early iterations of the system that it seemed like everybody was getting a 4 or 5 star ranking, or that many, many ones were. And I believe that ProPublica actually started publishing text searchable reports on nursing homes. And you had pretty sensationalistic stories, but also pretty important stories about people searching for the term rat droppings or rotten food, or, you know, different, whatever sort of bed sores, whatever your horror story is, whatever your worst case scenario is for a nursing home, people searching in these text reports and finding them sometimes at institutions that have been rated very highly by Nursing Home Compare. So this is a very interesting case study in a sort of interaction between public interest journalism at a place like ProPublica and a larger government effort to rate and rank nursing homes. And, you know, we could get into the weeds a bit in terms of exactly what the rankings are going to be relying on in our conversation, but I think the most important thing here is that you see that the Obama administration is continuing to entrench and to develop some of these consumer-directed initiatives that were the hallmarks of the Bush type of health approach. And I think that's really interesting. In your sense, in your experience, Nick, do you think that these ratings and rankings really are going to do much to help consumers choose nursing homes, or do you think this is all just a rather superficial effort to rank and rate them?
Well, it certainly is part of current policy. As I recall, the Affordable Care Act has nudges with regard to the rating, particularly moving it forward into physician rating. We've had hospital rating, at least by specialty, for a while, and nursing homes were the first. I think there is sort of the transparency information myth, isn't there, in healthcare decision making, in making these choices, that we've really never had an appropriate explanation from the folks pushing consumer directed healthcare. And while you say that consumer directed healthcare is sort of has faded somewhat, I think when you look at the high deductible plans that the exchanges and indeed group insurers are offering, when you look at the kind of financial contributions expected of folks such as in Indiana under the recently approved Indiana Medicaid expansion or demonstration project, I suppose one should actually call it, that this idea of shopping for quality, of consumers believing that they can find out information and make rational choices, or rather policymakers believing they will, still very much is in the picture. With regard to nursing homes, they have long been one of the least regulated parts of the healthcare system, ironically, given us baby boomers already making advance bookings to get into them. I think you really rely on state law to sort of rein in the worst. You'll get the odd fraud and abuse case brought by the feds. But primarily, this is a matter of state law and the good states as far as enforcement. I see quite a lot of action from California. Beyond that, it's It's rough, and I'm not sure this information, currently as it's presented anyway, is really of much use to any of us.
You know, it's a really interesting to think about this stuff, because I agree with your skepticism here. And I know that the academic literature by Kristen Madison and by Anne-Marie Marchiarilli, I think of those as two leading articles on rating and ranking healthcare quality, they have also brought together some skeptical empirical work saying that, you know, a lot of consumers don't know exactly what to do with the information. Now, here's one way, though, in which I think it could lead to change. I know that in the New York City context with restaurants, if you see a restaurant that has like a C rating for food quality, I'll usually avoid that restaurant. I think anybody that I know will usually avoid that one. I have a feeling that what will happen here is that perhaps the nursing homes that are ranked 1 or 2 out of 5 or that have very low star rankings, bottom 10%, that could be used as a real warning sign, you know, and they could start losing business, and perhaps just rightly so. However, that raises another issue, which, you know, gets to the core of the ideology here in terms of consumer choice, which is, do we really want to fiscally or monetarily punish the entities that are doing worst? And that's my big worry about philosophically these types of ranking systems is, you know, some people may say, oh, good, the worst are going to go out of business. But if they're all there is, and then someone's having to drive 200 miles to bring their loved one to a nursing home, you know, far, far away, is that really progress? I have to wonder about that.
Right. I think the specific announcement had some remarkably important pieces to it as far as the quality metrics, probably the most important being examining the use of drugs in nursing homes and some of the abuses going on there. So hopefully, again, do we conclude yet another topic here today, Frank, with the thought that maybe this is a warning shot to our friends in the nursing home industry?
I do agree, and it's funny because that was exactly what jumped out at me as well, the decreasing the use of antipsychotics, and I thought that was a very interesting move there, and, you know, extending the already important crusade against first physical restraints and now chemical restraints. So that was we're totally on the same wavelength with respect to what I think was the most important aspect of this announcement. Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about today, and it's really a question, and it's a question that was raised in a Politica. Story this week, which is given the accommodation that the FDA seems to be prepared to give the emerging health IT industry, particularly the mobile medical industry, the people creating these mHealth apps and so on that we both talked about so many times and sometimes get very excited about. That given all of that, why is it that industry is still pushing for legislation to sort of get the feds off their backs? The FDA is... if anything in the medical device space is probably under-regulating. Certainly, they have been taking a much softer approach over the last few years. Now, the FDA this week put out a slightly revised version of their guidance for industry and food and Food and Drug Administration staff dealing with mobile medical apps. And we first saw this in September 2013, I think, and it really hasn't changed very much in this iteration. But it takes really quite a sensible risk assessment approach. It identifies a couple of types of apps that can be dangerous They also, incidentally, can be quite useful. One of the types is one that actually does diagnostic work on you, and I think we'd all like that. And then it really takes a hands-off. We're not going to do any regulation with the other types of apps. We're not going to do anything to your Fitbit wearables or anything like that. We're going to take it really easy and see how things develop. And that seems an eminently sensible approach to me. And yet we are seeing frequent calls for legislation. So there's a piece, a bill before the House that's coming up, which basically tries and takes all of these mobile apps completely out of FDA jurisdiction. Since we don't really know what these things are doing yet, it strikes me as a sensible kind of approach that the FDA is taking. On the other hand, on the other side of the aisle, the argument is that we will not get true innovation while we're in a period of regulatory uncertainty. And I wondered how you'd tackle that one.
You know, I find the complaints here a case of the innovator doth protest too much. I sense that part of the role of innovation is not simply to put forward the cheapest possible, quickest app to solve, say, a particular problem, but it's also to deal with various types of legal requirements about the accuracy of the information conveyed, verification of that, whatever licensing might be appropriate. And I just sort of feel that there's already been such ample space carved out in this area that I don't understand the insistent pressure for Congress to do more. The sad thing to me is that if you look back on the whole history of food and drug regulation, usually it takes some disaster to lead to a new law. So, for example, you got, all the way back to the 1930s, there was this terrible elixir of sulfilamide, I think it was called, that caused blindness, and then that led to amendments in the Act. Then, of course, you have the terrible thalidomide situation. But what's odd now is that, you know, if we were in that political environment where if something terrible happened, legislation would be forthcoming, perhaps I'd be happier to see legislation now that went more of a deregulatory direction. But if you look at our current environment, Congress is so frozen. It seems to only be in sort of a one-way ratchet down towards deregulation, that even when you had that horrific thing happen with the compounding pharmacies and the meningitis happening because of the black mold in one of the largest compounding pharmacies, there was really no substantial legislative response to that. And so I feel as though folks who care about the safety of devices have to guard against any further handicapping of the FDA because they can't count on Congress to do much of anything, even if something horrific happens in the future.
I was watching a John Oliver show on HBO the other day, and he was taking on the supplement industry, and in particular, some of the claims by Dr. Oz and the hearings and stuff like that. And he went into the history of of FDA regulation, or should one say non-regulation of supplements. And he dug up a wonderful little TV interview dating back decades to when there had been an attempt to include supplements in full FDA jurisdiction, so you'd have a pre-sale scrutiny and so on. An expert who was interviewed in this clip said that there were more calls to Congress and complaints to Congress about people trying to take away their vitamins, which is how the industry sold the issue. There were more calls to Congress and complaints to Congress about that than there were with regard to the Vietnam War.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's really, and the problem is that people really want to believe that, you know, they just take this little magic pill. And, you know, I had this incredible experience once where there's this group called the Transhumanists, and Ray Kurzweil at MIT sort of believes that if you take enough of the right pills, you will live forever. And I had a brunch with a member of one of these group, and he took 52 pills with the brunch because he was so committed to this. He really believed this, and this was a very wealthy finance guy, someone who'd been very successful in finance, clearly knew a lot. But the so strong is the allure of this sort of like Ponce de Leon fountain of youth appeal of these things that I think it's really worrisome, and it's sad to see. And you know, a lot of people don't remember this, but in the 1990s, there were 38 deaths and 1,500 adverse events traced to L-tryptophan, this non-essential amino acid used in supplements. And you know, and I think that, you know, it's so easy for these things to go down the memory hole, while you know they're the hope that something like, say, the Scanadu is going to, you know, be this magical medical device that sort of totally disintermediates the primary care physician, that you just have so much deregulatory energy against anything that might delay its appearance. It's very troubling.
But then out of nowhere this week, we suddenly see an actual regulator actually trying to do something about the supplements. What happened?
Yes. So that's our fourth topic, and I'm so glad we had a nice transition into this one, which is that in New York, the Attorney General has demanded that many chains pull dietary aids off of their shelves until they can demonstrate that the claims that are made by these aids are actually backed up by something. And just to give a little bit of background on this, I mean, there was a very big win for the Federal Trade Commission recently in the Palm Wonderful case, where essentially they insisted that before the makers of this drink were able to say that it, you know, saved your heart and did all sorts of wonderful things for you, they actually had to come up with some substantiation of what they were doing. And so here, Attorney General Schneiderman in New York was saying to these places with the dietary aids, look, you know, show us exactly what's going on here. Show us that you have some evidence that these aids are actually helping people to lose weight or otherwise improving health. What's kind of amazing is that there was one study that was cited in this New York Times article on this initiative at the Well blog at the New York Times that said that even on the basis of being accurate about the herbs that were in the products, that 80% of the products they surveyed didn't even have the herbs that they said they had in them. So we're not even talking about efficacy here. We're not even talking about safety. We're talking about, like, are you even getting what you're being promised, something that's much more basic. And one of the things I hope that we'll be able to address in, you know, our future episodes is this rising role of, say, the Federal Trade Commission or state unfair competition regulators or consumer protection advocates in some of these areas of health where the feds may have sort of left the field open. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of these types of activities, particularly in California and New York. Do you see other state-level activity, Nick, or do you think this is an interesting model for going forward in the future?
I think it's very much restricted to those states at the moment. I'm not seeing a lot of activity beyond that, but it does open up another line of attack. And as I say, the FTC, while I think my favorite agency, is one allowed to have a favorite agency? I don't know, but my favorite agency. The FTC, for all its great work, and boy, have we seen some interesting stuff. Yes, the Palm case and the kind of things that they're doing in the sort of the health space and the security space. I know at some point there's going to be one of these shows talking about the Wyndham security complaint. Oh, yes. And stuff like that. So yes, it's great to see that FTC activity, but overall, the FTC is a relatively small, relatively understaffed agency. And so anytime they can get a helping hand from one of the big states, I think that moves the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is something that, you know, had an almost immediate effect. And I really applaud the Attorney General's office for going after this. I think New York is going to go down in history in health laws, leading some very important initiatives here.
Though I bet an awful lot of people are complaining that they're no longer getting their vitamins.
Yes. Well, I imagine they can take out that anger at the ballot box. We'll see if Attorney General, if Schneiderman gets turned out at the next election.
Indeed. So I think that was This Week in Health Law. I'm Nicholas Terry. You can follow me at Nicholas Terry, NicolasTerry on Twitter, where you can also contact me.
And I'm Frank Pasquale, and you can follow me on Twitter at HealthPI. That's HealthPI. And that's where I tweet on all matters health and technology law related.
And I hope we see you all another week. Thank you.